Welcome to another episode of Good Medicine is Cheaper Medicine. I'm Shelley Wrench, along with Dr. Nash Gabriel. We're from the Gabriel Cancer Center. And today I want to do a little bit of a rewind. If you remember when we were first kicking off these podcasts back in January, we had thought the first program would be strictly on why are we doing this? Why would we put ourselves into this every week? And then during that week, it was introduced by, a notice sent out by the local hospital that they were closing their doors within 30 days.
It was a Pearl Harbor of hospitals in Canton,
yeah,
where the owners of, what was the name of the owners of Affinity, they just front page in the repository, Affinity will close in 4 weeks. Thank you very much. And we were all scrambling. Oh, what's going to happen to the patients?
Yeah, so we thought that was more important at that time.
That was the first time that was the launching day.
That was the launching day.
And we were supposed to be discussing why we're doing this, but we thought that hospital closure was a little bit more critical.
So let's do a little bit of a rewind. Number one, Good Medicine is Cheaper Medicine is based on your book, your first book, right?
Right.
So we thought that you thought that the public needs to be educated about what actually is happening out there. Now, you wrote your book 10 years ago. A lot has changed in medicine over the last 10 years. So I think that we need to kick it up from your book and kind of, you know, go back to your book and look at some of the things that you said, and maybe things are different today than what they were 10 years ago, which they are. And let's tell the public why we want to do such education.
Shelley, let me tell you exactly. I think you knew why I wrote the book. It was about 12 years ago. Something struck me that for every dollar that we spent on healthcare in the U.S., Europe spends 62 cents. To me, that didn't make sense. When you look at the health outcomes or the quality of life, the quality of healthcare, even the longevity and lifespan, actually, the United States doesn't rank in the top 10. So that immediately puzzled me. How could it be that we spend more money than anybody else, and yet we are not number, we should be number one by a big gap? No, we are number 11 or 12, whatever it is. I also learned from my experience 3 years in Scotland and that was practice of 5 years in Iraq. And then start working here. I was in academia. That gave me some insight, and I started analyzing what is different between different healthcare systems. Specifically, why is it in the U.S. that we spend so much money, but our outcomes are not the best? So I start reading, studying, and actually, more than that, thinking for myself, what is it? I reached one simple conclusion from my observations, just observations, that overutilization is the key to our failure in the U.S. That the system in the U.S. is geared more into rewarding us for doing things that we don't need to do.
So what you're talking about is the more that you do testing, the more that you see patients, you're actually getting financially paid higher because you get fee for service payments.
Correct.
Unlike in Iraq and unlike the UK, where, you know, you're in academia and you just get paid a set paid amount and that's it.
Right. And so in the UK, doctors are paid salary, right? And the hospitals have a budget, and you have to live with that budget. And honestly,
I'm sure that budget is much higher than.
And Shelley, honestly, it was part. Yeah, I was a fellow there. It was part of my training to learn and practice how to be cost effective. Give you a good example. Part of my training as a fellow in hematology after my did internal medicine was I spent 1 month. Every 4 months in the lab, my job was simple, looking at the blood smears all day. A physician from the floor will send a blood count, whatever it is, and I look at the blood smear. But in addition to that, I also was the controller for testing done. So when a physician in the floor or a resident will ask for B12 and folate, my job was to look into the blood count, the CBC, and see, in my mind, which I was a training hematologist, whether that test was justified.
So you were doing UR way back in the day.
UR? Yes. But it wasn't UR like with arrogance. It was, I look and pick up the phone and call. I remember once vividly the intern sent me a case where the patient's anemic, and the diagnosis was dermatitis artifacta, in Latin meaning you're crazy, you just itch your skin, although you don't have skin disease. Okay. Artifacta being artificial. And I looked at the blood smear, I said, oh my gosh, this is awesome. I said, this is celiac disease. So I called the intern. He was asking for all the tests in the world, skin biopsy and all that. I called the intern and said, can I ask you a question? He said, what? I said, is the rash between shoulder blades? He said, how do you know? I said, the blood smear tells me that. The point is that intern will never forget that when you have a skin rash, of course, if you are dermatitis artifacta, I mean, if you just itch because you're nervous, the last thing you want to do is stretch your arm all the way between your shoulder blades. You will itch your cheeks. You will itch your thigh. Easy to get, right?
Right.
Point I'm making is the training was structured in a way that not only that you are cost effective, but you are scientific. And I was convinced that science and cost effectiveness run hand in hand. And if that theory is true, then the more money we spend, the lesser is the quality. And that was my conclusion in the book. And a lot of people said that was crazy.
And think about it, that blood smear is what, $12?
I used to do blood smear for the nuclear submarine base in the Glasgow, Scotland. That was American submarine base. My job was to look at their blood smear because there is nuclear exposure there. We want to make sure. So they used to pay me 26 sterling pounds. That's about $40 in those days.
Wow.
But it's amazing. And we were so good. The chairman of the department liked me so much. He said, I want you to do this because that money comes straight in my pocket. It doesn't go to the hospital. I said, whoa, $40. Remember, I was a fellow. I was making only £1,100 a month. It's about $1,700 a month. Doctors don't get paid very, very well there. Believe me. You know my friends who live in London. They complain about that.
So basically, the way that you talked about various things in healthcare in the book, like ER rooms and expensive hotels, which is the hospitals and, you know, all the payers and the Amish Church Fund, that's kind of what we want to do here is we want to get involved in each one of those topics. I mean, where is the failure of the cost of healthcare and how can we get better access at a lower cost and higher quality and better outcomes?
And see, and that was what bothered me the most. What bothered me the most was here we are wasting a lot of money in doing stuff that actually is to the detriment of the patients. Yet, when doctors want to do something that's critical for the patient, insurance companies give us pushback because the insurance companies, they have a budget. And they cannot exceed the budget because if they do, they will lose money. And also they will go back to the employer and say, we need more money. So the system is all, see how confabulated it is, confused system is. You go to the emergency room for any reason, insurance pay regardless.
Well, yeah, all it is, the emergency room, it's a receptionist desk for the hospital.
Yes.
For the hospital, which is a hotel.
It's exactly.
Expensive hotel.
And there is no limit to what you can do, what you can charge. In fact, if you look at the emergency rooms, they have SOPs, standard operating procedures, right? Mm-hmm. So you go to emergency room, you get your analysis, and you get EKG, and you get blood count, and you get chemistry. These are given regardless. So if you go with a headache, you get EKG. If you go with a pain in your leg, you might get EKG. Anytime, or you get something called troponin level. Anytime you get any abnormality in one of those, you end up being admitted because you need a justification or a reason. Give you a simple example, a simple theory, actually. Anytime you do any test on healthy people, there is about 5% chance you will find something abnormal that has no relevance. Now, people say, well, yeah, but when you find that and you don't act, lawyers will go after you. I don't know. Maybe I saw people say that a lot of the augmented healthcare costs in the U.S. is more based on defensive medicine. Honestly, and I mentioned in the book, I think it has to do with us physicians. Our medical education has shifted more into defensive medicine, cookbook medicine, pathway medicine, rather than the science of learning for physicians why and how and when. That's what you learn in medical school.
So what we're trying to do then is, what can we educate the public to do in order not to be sucked into that hospital visit? So, I mean, what can we tell them? What can we give them confidence in saying, you know, I'm not going to do that test, or what does the test cost before it's done, and what are you going to do with results? How can people know to take control of their own health care?
That is basically the essence of the book, and it end up being the essence or one of the reasons why we started the project, the on-site clinics.
Right.
And that's something we will discuss soon, right?
The on-site clinics for employers. Yeah.
For employers.
That's how you control it. That's total.
That one way of controlling it. Now, the individuals, remember, Shelley, when you go to the emergency room, or you go, you have a lump, and they did a biopsy, I think we talked about this a while ago, a few weeks ago, you are already weakened. Your spirit, your soul is weakened, because all of a sudden you are facing something very serious and deadly. And the last thing that comes to your mind is how to be my own self-advocate. As you know, most of the times the advocacy for the patient comes from family members, daughters usually.
Right.
Usually daughters. Because everybody knows the strongest person in the world, when they get hit with those bad words, cancer, immediately there is impending death. There is, what can I do? What did I do? Why did this happen to me? And it's totally paralyzing.
Right. And specifically in cancer, you know, one thing I'm thinking of is when one of our patients or a cancer patient goes to the ER and they're short of breath, and the physicians or the ER doc say, you know, we need a CAT scan of the chest. Understanding that they just had a CT of the chest 2 days before, they need to be empowered to say, wait a minute, can you get those results? We might need to do that, but can you get those results
first?
Wouldn't
it be nice if we can do that?
I mean, that's what the whole thing is going for. It's trying to communicate between everyone.
Wouldn't it be nice if we can do that? But again, it's sometimes it's hard. But what you really should think about is, there's studies that show that only 25% of emergency room visits are legitimate emergencies. There are people, you know, there are people who go to the emergency room with a paper cut in their hand. Really, they do.
And they do an EKG
sniffs,
for those.
And do EKG for them. Sniffs. Sore throat. Really. There are a lot of people who say that 80% of medical ailments can be treated by a nurse. That's absolutely true. The only problem is you need to have a lot of knowledge and experience to differentiate between the 80% that are simple easy and the 20%. But for the emergency room, yeah, if you break your ankle, for God's sake, you have to go. If it's a bad strain, a sprain in your hand, you have to go. But when you talk to the emergency room docs and nurses there, and what you see, it's terrible. Way overloaded. You go with cough, and if you're complaining too much, and if there is empty beds in the hospital,
you have pneumonia.
You have pneumonia.
Without even doing the testing, you've got pneumonia.
I have always made comments that when I can, any given day, I can walk in any hospital, and I will discharge about half of the patients because they don't need to be there. Now, hospitals might get upset about when they hear this, but you know what? This is my calling, that our employers in this town, who subsidize a lot of the healthcare cost, I think they need to be educated, and I think they need to be made aware that there is an over-utilization, and when there's over-utilization, their cost goes higher, and their competitiveness goes lower.
Right.
I mean, when I came to town in 1990, there were 25, 30 steel companies in Canton, Ohio. How many do we have now? What happened to them? Well, part of course, were the China and all that stuff, right? That's why the president wants to put the tariffs. Fact is, I think it's our moral duty that we, all of us, make sure that the businesses in this area stay viable and successful. But that's not it. My problem is, when we overdo things, we actually hurt people. And that's the challenge we face. How do we minimize the overutilization? Again, Shelley, in the beginning, you made the most remarkable statement ever, and that is, the system is skewed in a way that we get rewarded for being inefficient.
I don't know of any other career or area that has that.
Shelley, let me give you an example. This is really serious. That inefficiency is rewarded, and efficiency, on the other hand, absolutely punished. Give you an example. If you're a physician, family doc, a patient comes to you with a headache. If you're a good doc, you will sit down and listen to the headache. Where is it? What brings it? There are things that we learn in medical school to do. And you can, 90% of the time, you can reach a conclusion as to what it is and then act on it. Currently, what do we do? Most, a lot of us. You have a headache, CAT scan. If the CAT scan is negative, what do? MRI. And goes on and on and on. Whereas if you are a good doc, one visit will solve the problem, two visits maybe, and the cost is only about $200-$300. If you are trained and practicing testing for every symptom and referral, you actually make more money because you see those patients more often. And if you are employed by a hospital and you order those testings, your ranking in the hospital goes higher and higher.
You're a good boy.
You're a good boy, which means you become a leader.
Right.
Because you're so good. Whereas in reality, it's all the other way around. And so I thought about this. I mean, I wrote a book about this. The only solution is individual responsibility. And with that comes things like the HSA or the out-of-pocket or co-pays. That actually helps. If people act on it.
Right. I'm just curious, though, how can we educate people to know the difference between, yes, I need that test, and no, I don't? That's
Shelley,
something that we need to
Shelley,
figure
it's not
out.
Education. It's not education. One of the best books I have ever read, and you know I read a book every week, right, is Freakonomics and Super Freakonomics, two books in a row, written by the same guys. Actually, they have a radio program.
Right. And, I love them, by the way.
Huh?
I love that program, by the way.
I know, you listen to them every day. Two good books. The essence of the books are simple, really. Sigmund Freud, the psychologist, thought that the actions, the activities, the decisions of any creature, being an ant or a monkey or human, are all driven by sex. That the sexual desire and the sexual appetite is the ultimate. He was a sex maniac himself.
Well, think about that. All marketing has some kind of sex-driven aura,
right,
aura behind it. Yes.
But him, it was everything is basically excited or incited by sex. These guys, Levine and Dobbins, the authors
yes,
of Freakonomics, they say no. They say in humans, we don't know about animals because they don't have currency, right? But in humans, it is the dollar, is the money. That the economics is the ultimate factor, the ultimate incentive for human beings to behave. Think about this, Shelley. And I have no doubt in my mind. So you said, how can we convince people to say, well, this test, not, you know, this test, maybe I don't need it. Why should I do it? Shelley, how many times have we seen patients who say, I want an MRI. Well, you don't need it. Well, somebody's paying for it. Why not?
Yeah, absolutely.
When something is done, is paid by somebody for free, even, I can give you an example that's a sad story. A lady had breast cancer, and she had 2-3 positive nodes. She got chemo somewhere, but then she decided to come and see me. And I told her, you know, about the radiation. Listen, lady, you had the lymph node dissection. If we give you radiation, I don't believe it will add to your longevity, but you might expect major problems with edema and swelling. That's permanent. We call it lymphedema. There is a risk of even a rare cancer that develops in the area of radiation called angiosarcoma. She said, I still want the radiation. I said, fine. Could you explain to me why, despite my explanation? She said, you don't know. My insurance policy would pay me $8,000 if I take the radiation.
Yeah, I remember that.
I said, damn, how could you come with an insurance plan like this, incentivizing patients to actually overutilize? And she had, and now we're struggling with the edema in her arm. We prescribed for her one of those sleeves that don't work really, cost another $2,000 to $3,000. Point is, if people don't have the financial incentive to do something, preaching on them will not do it. I mean, besides money, really, besides money, there is only one other thing that can convince people to do what's right, and that is fear of God or fear of hell. Look at the Catholic Church. I mean, Dante had images and pictures of hell. You look at those images, oh my gosh, I don't want to go there.
They are scary.
And they tell you, and the church will tell you, if you do A or B or C or D, that's where you go, and that inferno is so hot. But otherwise, it's all about economics. It's all about money.
You know, I was just thinking of our Amish patients. I love our Amish patients. You know why? Because they believe exactly how we think. They're definitely held to their feet to the fire when it comes to paying for their health care. And they're asking the questions, you know, is this really needed? Can I get more of a discount? Do I really need this? So I think that they've got it right. And in fact, in your book, you have a whole chapter on the Amish church funds.
They do. The difference between the Amish is exactly what you said, and the rest of the society is, I think it's more a cohesive, compact society.
True.
They care. Look at them. The Amish church fund, this is how their philosophy is. The first $7,000, that's out of pocket, it's paid by the individual.
Deductible.
That's deductible. That's their plan. At least Amish church too, I think. But then after that, the Amish church will kick in, and I think there's some little copay. Once you reach a cap of $70,000, done. The church, Amish church fund, doesn't pay anymore. And you don't ask them, you know, talk about now the drugs, the gadgets we have now. If you get a CAR-T treatment, that's about $1 million.
Yeah.
So what they do, the poor guys, for those unfortunate individuals who face these catastrophic illnesses within 1 year, they do fundraisers, they do charity, they don't have cars to do car washes, whatever they do to get some of that money. Unfortunately, that's becoming unsustainable because reaching a $70,000 a year was a rarity 10 years ago.
Now it's really more attainable.
1 month you get it. Yeah. I mean, you get one of these checkpoint inhibitors, monoclonal antibodies, immunotherapy.
Even a hospital stay for 2 weeks.
Well, you remember the case of the baby 5 months at Akron, 5 days at Akron Children. And the total bill was what, 90, 80, well, how much was it?
It was like $67,000.
$60 or $70,000, and we were treating her father.
And the baby was being nursed, right? The mother was staying in the hospital with the baby, and yet they were giving the baby, I think it was $40 a day worth of multivitamins, really?
Right. Actually, I think even the Amish community is metamorphosing, if that's a word, like metamorphosis, where they are adjusting because on one hand, they've been attacked by the Chinese and the Mexicans with the... Remember when you went to buy furniture from there, you get this beautiful bed, $10,000, made by the Amish. You see a replica done in China for $3,000. So on one hand, they're being squeezed. And now with the healthcare, we just talked to some of them recently. They are trying to do something still within the confines of their faith and their cultural...
Yeah. And it's the biggest difference I see between employers trying to tell their employees, like, this is how you can save us money, especially the self-insured employers who we have a lot in our back pocket. The Amish community, it's more like they even care about those first dollars being spent. So they care about the whole community as a whole rather than the employees like, okay, I'm going to save the company money, but it's just me individually. They don't really care. So it's harder to move that vessel into lower cost healthcare rather than with the Amish community where they know that every dollar spent right from the get-go affects the whole community.
Exactly.
If we could just replicate that in the self-insured employer's world, that would be great. Like, how do we do this as a community?
Well, you know, there are things, we're coming close to the end, but this was an introduction about what do you want to do. We want to basically share, I hate the word educate, share information with patients and with employers.
Give them tools.
You know, expose what things are wrong in the society. But I can tell you one thing, Shelley. I happen to blame the government for everything wrong that happens in the society, and I never give the credit to the government for anything because I don't think they're capable of doing anything. I'll give you an example. Back in 1965, you were not born. Oh, you were born that year.
I was.
Social Security Act wasn't then. Of all the politicians, there was only one politician who said, guys, don't do it. There was one prominent politician who disagreed with the rest, and he told them, if you establish Medicare, you are opening a door for the government to control your life in ways that you will never imagine, and it can be bad. You know who that politician was?
Who?
My favorite one. Ronald Reagan. He was a governor in California. He was the only one documented in history that he was against having Medicare. Now, people might say, now, what, without Medicare? Think about it. That's what created the problems because now the way the system works is almost everybody follows what Medicare does. And Medicare is just, how did Reagan say? He said the government is like a baby, voracious appetite and uncontrollable sphincters. That's what he said about the government. And he's right. There is no, they pretend, the government, the CMS, Centrum Medicare, Medicaid, they pretend that they want to control costs. I just don't have faith in them that they are even capable of doing that. So we concentrate on the private sector.
Right. Well, this is our reintroduction of why we're doing these series, but it's been great. And all of our prior episodes are actually archived on our website, GabrielCancerCenter.com. And we hope to make sure that people actually get value out of what we're trying to, you know, give them the tools and the knowledge to do in their own healthcare.
In an unbiased way or at the least biased way as possible because humans cannot be unbiased.
Right.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you.